Welcome to 3GT, the podcast for three guys, a pastor, a professor, and a parishioner discuss theology from a practical standpoint, all from a Reformed perspective. Find out more at 3GT.xyz.
You have just tuned in to another episode of Three Guys Theologizing. Yes, you are on 3GT, and we're glad you're here. This is Barry York, president of Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary out in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And as more usual these days, I'm joined with my two co-hosts and buddies, Kyle Borg. I got to make sure I get it right this time, from Winchester, Kansas, the pastor there, as well as Scott Hunt, soon-to-be prosecuting attorney of Grant County in Marion, Indiana. So guys, I'm glad you're with me today. How are you doing?
Glad to be here. Scott's got such an intimidating title here. I don't feel worthy to even walk in the garden of his turbulence. So
yes.
It's good to be here, Barry. I'm not even going to comment on what Kyle said. I didn't even understand it. And it's not for another 6 months, but yeah. So I, just so you know, I am running unopposed. So as long as I get one vote in November, I will be elected the prosecutor. So I got to talk to one of my family members. Yes.
Yeah. We'll pray for that one vote to come through.
Although, yeah. You'd make history. You would make history if you get a single vote. I mean, that would be kind of exciting, wouldn't it?
It would be funny. Yeah. I mean, I would laugh at it later on in life, but maybe not in November.
Well, just so our listeners know, Kyle and I are sitting here in t-shirts, and Scott's looking all dapper in a sport coat with legal books behind him. And so he's looking the part. Well, we are not here alone, though. It's the three of us, but we're joined by another. And we have the honor today of having with us Pastor Gordon Keddy. Gordon is a retired pastor of the RPCNA. He just said that he's been 8 years retired now, which seems unbelievable to me. But so it is. He's also the author of numerous books, and he's also just a friend of us, and we're very glad to have him on 3GT once again. He has been on here before. So, Gordon, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for these kind words.
Well, we're glad to have you. And usually when we have Gordon on, it's to talk about a book that he's written, or I think the last time we talked about one of your books was actually with David Whitlick, because you helped him co-write that. But on this occasion, it's not actually a book that Gordon has written, but one that he worked to have republished and served as an editor for. And it's called The Glory and Fullness of Jesus Christ by William McEwen. And it has the subtitle, In the Most Remarkable Types, Figures, and Allegories of the Old Testament. And just so you know, Gordon, I've been actually this summer reading through this book devotionally and have been greatly blessed by it. So I'm very thankful to have it in my hands. And I'm glad that you can be here to talk with us about it. And I thought it'd be helpful just to introduce McEwen to us as well as to our listeners. So could you just give us some background upon this minister?
Yes. Well, maybe the first thing I should say is that one of the blessings of my being retired is that I've discovered it's much easier to write other people's books. And that's how I got into the editing business.
Ah, there you go.
But the serious side of it is that, again, this is also, before we get to McEwen himself, is the realization that what we need at the present day, apart from books on relevant and useful subjects, is we need stuff that people can read that's accessible. And so often the publication that is merely the photocopying, as it were, of classic works with the muddy type of the 18th century or earlier or whatever, is really difficult. I remember years and years ago, maybe 30 years ago, Walt Chantry, who was famous Reformed Baptist minister in Pennsylvania and Carlisle, mm-hmm. was telling me that how disappointed he was in a way with the the effect of just reprinting books, that it tended to be something that interested kind of collectors, you know, and people who were really committed to reading the Puritans or the Scottish Presbyterians or something like that. And the thing that struck me is that we need editing and we need fresh type and we need some effort at least to make these things accessible. And anyway, that said, that's become kind of an aim that I have as long as I'm spared.
Yes, that's a good aim.
I've got other things that are in my mind, at least in the pipeline, if I am. Anyway, to go to Willie McEwen, or William McEwen, I should call him.
You knew him as Willie, did you, Gordon?
I personally, yes, call him. I know him as Willie.
I love that.
He was just a young fellow, you know. He's still a young fellow.
Yeah.
200 years on, 300 years on, almost, it's going on. Yeah. But anyway, I cannot remember when I came across him. It was many years ago. And William McEwen was a minister of the Secession Church. He was born in 1735. He died in 1763 or two. It's in the book anyway. I did a biography somewhere.
And, he died young.
So he died at the age of 27. The only thing that was published in his lifetime is the last item in this book, which is a record of the great matter and end of gospel preaching, but it is the text not only of his sermon on that occasion, it was at an ordination in Aberdeen, but it also gives the addresses, a charge to the pastor, charge to the congregation, and it's a wonderful piece. I think it hint it should be essential reading for our guys. It would just be helpful to see what was done. Now, he was about 23, I think, when he did this. Can you imagine asking a 23-year-old to preside at an ordination? He was licensed to preach at 18. He was ordained possibly at 19, but certainly at 20. And he was dead of a terrible cold, basically, when he was 27 and had just been married for 10 days. And what was left were literary remains and memories of people, and particularly his friend John Patterson in Edinburgh, he, a seceder minister, they were members of the Burgher Synod, and Patterson had taken from McEwen had delivered to him on his trip to Edinburgh from Dundee. He was pastor of the Secession Church in the city of Dundee. And he gave him the manuscript of The Glory and Fullness of Christ. It was called Grace and Truth. And then The Glory and Fullness of Christ was, the rest of it was a subtitle. And I retitled it because I thought it's about the glory and fullness of Jesus Christ. And the rest of it can be the subtitle. And and then people will know what's in there, you know, grace and truth, too general. And he gave that to Patterson. He went off to catch the ship to Dundee, and he fell ill and he died. And he was buried, I believe, in Dalkeith, 12 miles south of Edinburgh. I'm from Edinburgh myself and I know Dalkeith, but I haven't been at the graveyard. But he's buried there. He never got back to Dundee, dead or alive. And so what a desperate tragedy it was. And yet he's lived on. And Patterson took the book to the printer, as he was going to do, and it was published. And then it remained in print for most of 100 years, for about 80 odd years. And it was known as McEwen on the Types. And you know, that's the provenance of the book. Now, he did one other volume. Well, he didn't really do it. Patterson gathered together a collection of his rewritten sermons, which was published a few years later, 1767. Patterson was the editor, and biographer too. And this book, The Select Essays, consists of 98 pieces. And one of the amazing things about that is that I will say, first of all, I have a contract for it to be printed by Reformation Heritage, also as the other volume in what will be effectively the collective work, collected works of William McEwen. It needed reorganization because it was cobbled together by Patterson, and then they found things and they put this in and different editors, and it was in print for about 100 years. And both sides of the Atlantic, by the way, in both cases. And what was distinctive about the second one is that the simplicity of the first, because when he deals with the types, is devotional reading, but it's incredibly sound and restrained. The Select Essays takes his, this is how I see it anyway, takes his sermons and makes them simpler. Now, when John Owen took his sermons, he made them more complicated. And you wonder now, how did he manage an 80-page sermon? And the answer is, he wrote it. He didn't preach it. Yeah. And the thing about McEwen is, almost uniquely, I think, among the older writers, he took his, first of all, they didn't take notes into the pulpit. They prepared a sermon. They went into the pulpit, memorized it, went into the pulpit, preached away, depending on the Spirit. And then if the Spirit moved them, they went home and wrote it out. Mm-hmm. And in this case, though, when he wrote things out, his meditations ended up being 3 pages instead of 80 pages or even 30 pages. So there's going to be a volume next fall, God willing, with 98 meditations, and it covers a whole range of theological subjects. And the thing is, and here was, I'm coming back to William McEwen and why I was interested in it. Both of these books and the types, The Glory and Fullness of Christ that you have before you, is something that anybody can read, and preachers can maybe use these as, I don't know, I wouldn't say, you know, you can, there are 45 items in this book. You've got a year's worth of material. You know, if you're a plagiarist, that makes it easier. But the thing is, it's understandable. And then on top of that, this fellow's style is unique. He and James Harvey, who did Theron and Aspasio, and very florid writers. At the same time, Harvey outlived McEwen, though he was older. But these men were very florid in their style, but they're not silly in their style. They're not merely fancy. There's incredible literary skill. And in the middle of all this and surrounding it is an incredible understanding of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And it comes through, and it's just you're confronted with it. Anyway, that's what attracted my attention. And then I decided, okay, I'm going to go through this, and I'm going to divide it up, give headings, take headings out of his text where appropriate, and make it a more modern looking and sounding book. And Reformation Heritage have done a beautiful job. And Jay Collier, who is the guy who handles the editing there, was tremendously helpful. Yes. And I think that's the kind of thing we need to happen to older books.
So. Yes. Well, that's a good background. And you've answered a couple of questions I was already prepared to ask. And you've even given us a preview of a coming book. So you've done a lot there. So I'd like to, you know, for the sake of our listeners, Gordon, if you could just help them to understand a little bit more about what's contained within the book. And you might have to help them to just we're using the word topology here. So maybe define topology for our listeners and then give them a little taste of McEwen, some of the ways that you were particularly blessed.
Well, type is simply a foreshadowing, tupos. It's something in the Bible that is, in this particular case, foreshadowing Christ. And McEwen organized his book in terms of typical persons, mm-hmm, and typical things and typical places. And who are the typical persons? Christ and Adam compared, Noah, Melchizedek, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, the priesthood, Joshua, Samson, David, Solomon, Jonah, and that's it. They are the people. You know, they're typical people. In other words, you go there and a type is a foreshadowing, and the type can be a person. And how do you choose which person? Well, you have to take account of it's the analogia fidei, the analogy of scripture, comparing scripture with scripture. Is there evidence that Jonah, for example, is held in the Bible to be a foreshadowing of Jesus? And the answer to that is yes. You see, even though Jonah, of course, was not a paragon of altogether of virtue, nevertheless, David too. You see, you have passages in the scripture which shed light on how to treat that particular individual. You don't just go to your New Testament, you know, and say, well, I wonder what Demas foreshadows, you know, who had forsaken the apostle. and actually, there's a problem here, because typology there's a great work in typology published by Patrick Fairbairn in the 1840s, 1841, I think it was. And the interesting thing is that it was in the 1840s that they stopped reprinting McEwen. And Fairbairn says there, in his great, I mean, it's a theological discourse, you know, it's about 4 inches thick. And he notes that typology has fallen on evil days, that there was a declining interest. So Fairbairn comes in, this great theologian of the Free Church, and he, in the later 40s, I should say, because it was after 1843, I think. But anyway, he comes in and he's doing his work because he doesn't want typology to die. But typology did kind of die, and it died in the 20th century among more serious Reformed types or serious Christians, serious exegetes, because there was so much fanciful stuff. Now, I'll give you an example of fanciful typology.
After, please do.
When I was, sorry?
I said, please do. I'm sure this will be good.
Well, it was in Toronto in 1973. So, and I had just graduated from RPTS. Yay. And I was doing a summer between the Free Church of Scotland in Toronto and the Free Church of Scotland in Detroit. And I was in Toronto, and lo and behold, there was a meeting in Knox Presbyterian Church of Canada, an evangelical congregation in those days anyway. And the preacher was Alan Redpath from Moody Church in Chicago. Well, it so happened that a few years before I came to America and I was a teenager, Alan Redpath was minister of Charlotte Baptist Chapel in Edinburgh, and I had pals who were in that church, and I used to go to hear Alan Redpath in the evenings. And I went to the liberal church I was brought up in the mornings, and I went to this Baptist evangelical church in the evening for a while, and then I left the Church of Scotland eventually. I went to university, and that was it. So anyway, I thought, wow, Alan Redpath's going to be... So I went along, and he's preaching. What is he preaching on? Well, his text was Ezekiel 47, which is about the river of life part. The river comes out from the temple, and it goes to the east. And you see in the vision, the prophet goes into the river of life. He's up to his ankles. And he goes another 1,000 cubits,
into the along the river, and he's up to his knees, and then he's up to his waist, then he has to swim. I think it's actually just 2,000, and then he's up to his neck, he's swimming. Oh, says Alec Redpath. Yes, you see, when you're only up to your ankles in the Christian life, first of all, the river of life is the Christian life. Okay, you see how easy it is to find something. So when you're only up to your ankles, what do people see? They see you, because the water's only up to your ankles, like you're an inferior Christian. You're a sort of Christian. You're a nominal Christian. You know, you're keen enough to allow your feet to get wet, but that's all. And then, then it gets higher, you see? And they see less of you and more of the Christian life. And then you're forced to swim, and you're swimming. And what do they see? They only see your head. And he said, pointing upwards, it's funny, the things you remember, you know, going back all these years. I mean, it was 50 years ago. And I read in my Bible, the head of every man is Christ.
You know, that sounds like a great 3-point sermon. I think I'm going to change my text for Sunday morning. So,
well, there you are. You see, actually, Redpath was a good preacher, except he always preached the same sermon, though the texts were different. But that, by the way. And so there's a case where, you know, you're looking for meaning in the Bible.
Yes.
And you can find, when I was at Westminster, in my first 2 years at Westminster, and then I did a year that was required at RPTS, and that's when I graduated in 73. In the 2 years I was at Westminster before I went to RPTS and the year afterwards, one of the things that went around was what they called, they used to talk about pot rock theology. There's a lot of pot rock theology in the world these days, say. And what does that mean? And they said, well, it means there's a covenant in every pot in the Bible, you know, like in Sinaiticus in the monastery in Sinai. There's a covenant in every pot and a Christ under every rock. In other words, you've got all these possibilities. And you see, I think typology was ruined by that. Now, here's the great thing, I think, about McEwen, it says restraint. You know, here's the table of contents, you know, book one, typical persons, you recognize them all. The case is clear. Typical things, Jacob's ladder, burning bush, pillar of cloud and fire, manna in the wilderness, and so on, the ordinance of the red heifer and so on. The typical places, the cities of refuge, temple of Solomon, the various ordinances that are connected with the furniture and so on. So you have an outline of things that are really not at all disputable, and they're not fanciful.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, even when it comes to some specifics, I wanted to just point out on page 112, he's discussing the rock in the wilderness out of Exodus 17. And here's the rock. It was a test of faith. You know, Moses, they want water and so on. And he then, I put the heading in, but his second heading is the rock was Christ. How do we know that? Well, he says 1 Corinthians 10:4.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it says. The rock was Christ. So he takes us from Exodus 17. To 1 Corinthians 10. Now, he then starts to expound this. And here's what he says about the rock. He says, first of all, the rock itself might be an emblem of his person. He says it in a gentle, suggestive, yet authoritative way. He doesn't kind of start plucking stuff out and being just, oh, see how knowledgeable I am. I've discovered this.
you know, I keep, now that I listen to people, I hear too many preachers saying, and we're all guilty of it. I'm guilty. I was guilty of it. I want you to know this. You know, that's the temptation. I want you to know what I've discovered. He says, well, no, the rock itself might be an emblem of his person, in whom is everlasting strength, to whom we may fly as a refuge. And he's bringing in, you see, the meaning of rocks in the Bible. But it's not part rock. It's not a covenanted, a Messiah under every rock. But it is an exposition of aspects of the figure of speech that a type really is. And then he says, the smiting of the rock might prefigure Jesus' satisfactory sufferings, who was stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. See, by the time you get to the end of the sentence, and it goes on, like, you know, all these, that's one of the jobs of an editor of old books, by the way, is to chop the sentences up.
Yes, yes.
And because they're all too long, you know, they're half a page, whatnot. But by the time you get to the end of the sentence, you wonder, why would I ever doubt that the smiting of the rock didn't prefigure Jesus' satisfactory sufferings? You know, it might, but by the end, hey, I'm convinced. Yes. I surrender.
Yes.
You know, I believe this stuff. And he's made the case. And then he says, the water that issues from the rock. Now, here's another device. The water that issues from the rock, what might it signify? You see, I'm darn. I knew this Baptist preacher in Canada who used to, he was a great fellow. But he used to, when he wanted to make a point, he would bang on the pulpit, then he would jump out to the side and get down on his knees, and he would tell you what you had to believe. Okay, it was great. But McEwen, he's asking you a question. What might it signify? And you're thinking, what did I miss? And then he says, shall we say it is an emblem of the glad tidings of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Drive it home.
Yes, yes.
Now that's brilliance. It's simple,
yeah.
But it's brilliant because it is simple. The best brilliance is simple.
Yes.
And so that's the kind of thing. And then he talks about the rock gave abundant provision. And the rock, that Christ is the rock who loves us.
Yes.
And so there's always the gospel. And his last sentence, oh, grant us to believe on Christ that we may never thirst. And in that particular little chapter, you have a wonderful exposition, actually. I wonder, he's a wonderful example of his method, where he's drawing you into this. And then he's showing you from Scripture what it's about. That's right. A type.
Yes. Wow. All right, Gordon, I'll play the editor here and cut you just real quick, because I want to ask you this question. You've talked a little bit about the temptation and topology to bleed over into allegorization. And you also talk in the book how, though, in a lot of modern treatments of topology, there's sort of a straitjacket approach. And how do you keep that balance when you're treating? And I know you're going to say, well, do what McEwen does. But what, as you look at McEwen, what is he doing to develop such a rich topology? You use the word he's restrained, so he doesn't go too far. But what is it? And I think you've pointed out several things. But if you had to really highlight just key lessons we can learn from McEwen, what would you say they are in doing topology well?
Oh, I kind of thought when I first read it, you know, and I have the little paperback that I got from Harvard Bookstore way back, and you need a magnifying glass to read it. But I thought, you know, the thing that strikes me about after I've read it is that I'm the child. And he's the guy that has understood the Bible. But here's the thing. His understanding is childlike in the best biblical sense.
He comes before it. He's not looking to make footnotes and tell us how clever he is. Uh-huh. You know that Martin Lloyd-Jones in his Preaching and Preachers somewhere, I haven't read it for 40 years, but or 50 years, but it says something. There are these preachers who have got to, they've got to share their homework with us. Mm-hmm. When you read this man, you know his homework is with his open Bible, and he's praying it, and he's given by the grace of God a love for the people where he's simple and straightforward and yet profound. And that will appear even more obvious in the other book, which has got fabulous stuff in it. I mean, it's just so simple and down to earth. And it's experientialism in the best sense. And it's an understanding of where ordinary people in a small Scottish city in the middle of the 18th century were. They were literate, but they were simple people living in a country that was troubled by rebellions in the previous generations and so on. I think it is just sitting down under the Bible and resisting the temptation. My great temptation in making sermons was always, I don't want to miss something, first of all, so that I've got 10 commentaries out, I started with, you know, that kind of thing. And I got over that pretty quickly. But the temptation is to show people you've done your homework. And unfortunately, we have such a refining of education for the ministry that we're doing all sorts of things in seminary that are really bringing us into more details sometimes than we can actually translate into ministry to people. Uh-huh. And I think here's the thing, though. He had done his homework, didn't have so many books to read. I mean, people in those days, ministers in those days, didn't have a library, a fraction of that splendid library behind Kyle. They got a book. Wow, it was like a great thing to I bought a book last year. And expensive and so on. And so they didn't have YouTube and they didn't have TV and they didn't have podcasts to listen to. So there's a focus and they were fragile in many respects in that life was short, you know. And Andrew Gray was 22 when he, or 21 or 22 when he died. He'd been in the ministry 2 years. And he's was a beautiful writer, you know, and lives on. So,
you know what, Gordon, I love so much of what you're saying. I could just sit here and just hit the record and listen to you. But, you know, one thing that I really appreciate what I hear you saying to whet the appetite of readers, you know, I think you're right to point out that the field of typology or biblical theology, things like that today, I don't mean this irreverently, but oftentimes Christ is brought forth like the rabbit that's pulled from the hat as a big trick, right? Like, now let me show you this brilliant place and ta-da, here's where Jesus can be found in this passage. And it's probably well-intentioned, if I'm going to be charitable, because people want the scriptures to drive us to Christ. But you said something that I so appreciate and want to emphasize, and that is that McEwen or others like Andrew Gray, these other men you've been talking about, we're concerned about ministry to people. I remember in my studies, and oftentimes even in the books that I read, some of which are lining the shelves, most of which are now in the basement because they're second tier books, you know, there is this loss of ministering to people. Typology is a part of scripture. It's a part of what we need to see, but it's a servant to ministry. It's a servant to ministering to the people of God for their gathering and their perfection. And I think that's one of the things that I so appreciate about what you're saying about this book is that's That's what was in focus, is how do we minister this simply and effectually to people where they are?
Yeah. These are really models for ministers making sermons. Mm-hmm. You know, that you're interacting with the Bible. I mean, there are, you go through there and you see the citations of scripture. All but 12 of them were put in there by me. He only cited scripture in 4 chapters. Hmm. 12 in 4 chapters.
And when you say cite, you mean putting the references down, because what you're getting ready to say is the whole thing is just filled with scripture.
Breathing the Bible. He's breathing the Bible. And you know, this is the thing. We need ourselves a deeper experience of grace and of the Bible itself. I feel very, I didn't memorize a text passage of scripture until I was converted, really, at the age of 17. Mm-hmm. And I've never really gotten into the way of memorization of the scriptures. I know where to find things and all the rest of it. But these guys, they lived in the Bible, and they lived in the experience of the Bible's application to the soul. They weren't just, one of the things I used to hate was when somebody, hate, that's a big word, but people would shake my hand at the door and say, good job. And I wanted to say, it's not a job. It's not a job. I'm not just doing a little, you know, essay, because that's what preachers do. And I think what you see here is you know, are examples of sermons that I can hear him preach, I like to say, to his congregation of ordinary folks from the city of Dundee, you know, back in the early days of the first generation of this secession. What can I say? I don't know. There's a lot to learn here, and about simplicity and breathing the scriptures. One of the things, this is perhaps off to one side, one of the things I find very frustrating since I've come to listen to preaching, and I don't wish this to be cause of speculation. Who is he listening to? Well, we know who he's listening to week by week. Or listening to on the, you know, the 3GT, you know, podcast. I want the preachers to have the Bible there, and when they're expounding, not just give me an essay on what they think is a kind of topical summary of what's in the text, but I want them to go through the text. And I don't mean be a commentary on the text, but always bring the people to the text. Make them look it up. Repeat it. Repeat the verse. Make them look it up. Explain the verse in these words, then different words, with passion. Mm-hmm. And instead of just saying, right, well, you read the passage, then you say your topical piece on whatever you think is the outline or the theme. People need to be faced again and again with the Bible and with the gospel. Mm-hmm. And not a simplistic, just ask Jesus into your heart, but here's the gospel in another of its aspects, and so on. And when I began, I used to wonder, I'm going to be 100 sermons this first year in the ministry. How am I going to do that? Managed to scrape through seminary with about 20, I think. And how am I going to think up anything? And well, I didn't even get to preach through the whole Bible in the 40 years I was in the pulpit. So it's the heart, though, isn't it? It really is. And that's, I think, the great usefulness of William McEwen.
Yeah.
This young fellow who's got an old head on his young shoulders, head.
Well, Gordon, it's been great to hear you talk about it. I know you've whetted the appetite of many to get their hands on this. I did want to make Kyle hold up the copy of McEwen that he has.
I emailed Gordon when I found out this book was coming out by him, because years ago, I found a copy printed in 1849. And I bought it for $60. I spent $60.
You chided me.
I did. I thought,
taking the value away from your little book. That's
exactly.
The last
you have now stolen the value. This thing would probably go for $5 now. So I found it on a used bookshelf, thinking I'll never find this reprinted again. And then
even among Christians, there's a sucker born every minute who come up with $60 for that book.
It's true.
I think that's the last edition, that one, the 1849.
Okay. All right. Wow.
Well, Gordon, thank you so much for joining us on Three Guys Theologizing, and we're glad the rest of you have listened in. We'd like to give away a copy of this book, The Glory and Fullness of Jesus Christ by William McEwen, and if you'd like to enter to win a copy of that, you need to send us an email over at 3gt.xyz@gmail.com, and in your email, you need to give us your name and address, and you need to tell us who was the first editor of McEwen's book. We want to make sure you listen to this podcast. So who was the first editor? We know who the last editor has been, but who's the first editor of McEwen's work? And if you enter, we will have a drawing and send the providential winner that book. Thank you again for listening to 3GT. If you'd like to learn more about us, you can go over to our website at 3gt.xyz. Until next time, thank you.